Some point in the summer, I injured my right shoulder. I'm not exactly sure. Well, you appreciate the concern, Cole. That was a loud gasp. I injured my shoulder this summer, and I don't know exactly how or when. It started kind of hurting, got a little worse. And it was probably when I was working out. And so in the summer at camp and different things, I took a couple weeks off of working out. And I thought, if I just get away from kind of, you know, using it, then maybe it will get better. Well, by the time I got past those couple of weeks off, I found that my shoulder was actually more sore, and it was hurting a lot more than it had even before that. And so I did what most guys do in a situation like that. I just ignored it. I was like, I'm good, you know, I'll be fine. And I got to the point where I'd get up and I'd groan even more than I normally do, you know, because of just getting out of bed and my shoulder was just bothering me. So I talked with some different people, and someone recommended someone local here in town who is a chiropractor but also does physical therapy. And they said, you need to go see this guy, this doctor. He'll help you out. He'll at least be able to diagnose some things. And this is a great guy. I really like him. It's one of those people, there are certain people that you like get to know and you're like, man, that guy, I really like him. He's really a cool guy. He's friendly. He's personable. But I got to be honest, I don't enjoy my time there with him. Some of you are laughing because you know this, like, I've heard this before, but physical therapy is painful. It is not a pleasant experience. He hurts me. He hurts me. And he told me the first time I was there, he said, your shoulder is going to probably hurt more. It's going to hurt worse before it gets better. And I was like, yeah, no big deal. I took way too long to get here. I've been dealing with pain. I'll be fine. He was not lying, okay? I wonder if back in the day when the king had the torturer, I think we just relabeled that physical therapist, okay? This dude has this big metal cylinder thing. It's heavy. And he will put that down on my shoulder. And at first you're like, oh, that's kind of nice. Oh! And then he like leans into it. It's this heavy thing. He's like stretching out my muscle. And then he has these straps that he'll wrap around my arm. And within 10 seconds, he does it so tight, my arm begins to tingle a little bit. And I change colors on my arm, and then he has me move my arm all around. And, I know you don't want to know this, I'm going to tell you anyway, because I got to endure the pain. It's not the pain of moving it. It's the tightness of the strap around my armpit hair, like tearing, as it's terrible. It's terrible. It's terrible. But then he has this metal curved thing that he does. He gets a little icy hot and puts that on there. And it's not a blade, but it kind of looks like a curved blade. And he calls it scraping. He will scrape out on the muscle. He thinks maybe there's some scar tissue there that's causing a little bit of cracking and popping in my arms. So he will scrape it out. It is painful. It's not fun. So why do I go? Why do I go? It's because I know that the experience of hurt will be what actually helps me to heal. You know, that scar tissue needs to be worn down or moved away so that the pain will go away. You know, church, there's a difference between hurting someone and harming someone, right? There's a significant difference between hurting someone and harming someone. A physical therapist will hurt you, but they're not harming you. They're hurting you in order to bring healing to you, in order to help you. And in the same way, sometimes God will hurt you in order to heal you. Sometimes God doesn't apply physical therapy to our lives, but spiritual therapy to our lives, where he stretches us, he applies pressure to our lives, he breaks us down so that way he can then build us back up. Last week we started a series of messages on the Old Testament book of Habakkuk. And this is one of those prophetic books in the Old Testament that maybe you've read, maybe you've flipped through, and there's a bunch of those. There's like 12 of them near the end of the Old Testament with really funny names. It was written a long time ago, but as we began to see last week in the first week of this series, and as we'll see this week and in the upcoming weeks, the message is still absolutely relevant for us today. Habakkuk, as a prophet and as a book, is really unique from the other prophets. All of the other prophets that we see in the scriptures, they are confronting God's people. They are talking to God's people about the ways they have erred and turned away. But Habakkuk doesn't do that. Instead, he turns to God and he confronts God. He has all sorts of questions for him. And we saw many of those questions last week. God, where are you? God, look at all the things that are happening around me. Why are you allowing this to happen? I see violence. Society is falling apart. There are problems everywhere I look. Last week, we saw that we can and we should go to God with our questions. We should go to him. Instead of being frustrated with God, we should bring our frustrations to God. We have a tendency, I think, sometimes just to kind of talk about God when things are bad. But the prophet Habakkuk reminds us that we are to talk to God when we face difficulties and questions and trials. Now, the prophet's questions create all sorts of tension, I think, that we can understand and identify with today in our world. Because when we look at our world around us, I think we have similar questions. God, where are you? God, there's so much injustice that I see all around me. There's so much pain, and there's so much frustration and hurting. We have death and famine, acts of nature. We see humans behaving really badly towards one another. And we could just go on and on with all the different grievances and questions and problems that we face. At the end of Habakkuk's first complaint, we are left wondering, is God going to respond? I mean, is Habakkuk really appropriately addressing God? Is he talking to God in a way that he should? Because he's pretty bold. He's pretty direct with God. How is he going to respond? And God does respond, and we looked at this first verse briefly last week. Verse 5, it says this. Look at the nations, God says, and watch, and be utterly amazed. For I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. So God responds to all of these questions and all of these complaints and all of these problems that Habakkuk has. And he says, look, first, don't worry. I see all this. I'm working. I've got a plan. And secondly, the plan that I have is going to shock you. Literally, you could translate the Hebrew here, astound yourselves and be astounded. God is saying to the prophet here, you might want to sit down here because what I'm going to say is going to be tough for you to take. He continues on and he tells them this difficult message in verse 6. He says, I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwellings not their own. You know, I think Habakkuk's jaw dropped when he heard this. This was certainly not something that he was expecting. The Babylonians are known by two words here, ruthless and impetuous. You ever hear that expression, his reputation preceded him? That's how it is with the Babylonian people. They were known for their cruelty, okay, and the speed with which they conquered nations. They had a swift rise to power, and they did it at the expense of anyone that got in their way and people who weren't even in their way that they just wanted to roll over also. They were a menacing people. We get a great description of them in the next several verses. Verse 7, God says they are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honor. God's talking about their arrogance and their military power. He says they're a law to themselves. They don't submit to anybody else's laws. They do what they want, how they want, the way they want, when they want, and they do it, God says, all for their own power and all for their own glory. This is what often goes hand in hand, pride and power. And for the Babylonians, that was certainly the case. God continues. He describes their army and their cavalry. He says in verse 8, their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Wolves are nocturnal, and they hunt at night so they can eat. Anybody ever been hangry in the room? We got some hangry wolves that are just violent, and they're tenacious. That's what the Babylonians are described as people who are, they're out for the hunt, and they are hungry. The cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swooping to devour. I mean, who can stand against an army of this magnitude? This is the people that God is bringing against his people. This is the hurt that is coming. This is the hurt that God is bringing on his people. Verse 9, it says, they all come intent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. Do you remember what Habakkuk said in verses 2 and 3 of the beginning of this chapter? Habakkuk says, God, violence. I see violence. God, where are you at? Your people here in the southern kingdom of Judah, there's violence. I see this all around. Habakkuk mentions it twice. And God responds here, and the Lord's answer to the violence that the prophet is seeing in his own country and his own people is more violence at the hand of this wicked people. No wonder God told the prophet that he would not believe what he was told. The hordes of this army are described like a desert wind. And just like the desert wind comes in and picks up grains of sand and moves it off, in the same way, these people are going to come in and they're going to pick up God's people and they're going to carry them off into captivity. Verse 10, they mock kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities. By building earthen ramps, they captured them. You know, there are some people in life that we come across that are intimidating, right? And you're kind of like, oh, that person, you know, just kind of intimidating. But the people that you really need to be afraid of are the people that aren't afraid of anyone or anything, right? You remember that scene in Christmas Story where Ralphie finally has enough of the bully Scut? Remember the bully Scut in that movie? And Ralphie loses all fear. And, you know, Scut is like twice the height of Ralphie. And Ralphie just goes nuts. He goes off. He just starts wailing on the bully. And the bully ends up crying. And it's this big turn. Because at some point, Ralphie said, I'm not afraid anymore. And he just goes out and attacks. That's how the Babylonians are. They are not afraid of anyone or anything. They're described as mocking kings. Kings have armies. Kings have fortified cities. But for the Babylonians, they just laugh. Oh, you have an army. We don't care about that. We're just going to overwhelm you with our horses and our warriors. Oh, you have a fortified city? We're just going to move earth. We're going to dig a tunnel. And as we dig that tunnel, we're going to take the dirt out and we're going to build a ramp up to your walls. And one way or the other, we're not sure which is going to happen first, but we're going to make our way through. We're going to build a war machine and we're going to roll that up over the wall and you're done. So we're just going to laugh at you as we do this. These are devastating armies that took over great regions. The Assyrian Empire was the empire that stretched through that area, and the Babylonians just rise up and they're like, well, we're going to laugh at you. We don't care. Through sheer force, they would overcome any defenses of a city. Verse 11, they sweep past like the wind and go on, guilty people whose strength is their God. So as quickly as they arrive, that's as quickly as they move on to the next victim, leaving devastation on their way. Now, in the midst of all of these horrible descriptions of the pain and the hurt that God is bringing on his people, in the midst of all of that, God says something really important here, right at the end of his response. He says this, he says, the Babylonians are guilty. He says, the Babylonians are guilty people. He's clarifying to the prophet. He says, look, I know that these people are guilty. In spite of that, I'm going to use them to judge you. I'm going to use them to bring pain. They aren't going to worship me. They're not going to acknowledge me. They're not going to thank me. They're going to worship their own strength. And that's God's response. Habakkuk has all these questions. God, where are you? What are you doing? I see violence among your people. There's all these problems. The life is not going the way I expect it to. What are you going to do about it? And God says, hey, I got this under control. I'm going to send some people who are worse than you to defeat you and to punish you. Now, does this sound a little unsettling to you? I mean, I told you last week that the book of Habakkuk is not a sitcom kind of story. There's no sitcom ending at the end of this story or even as we go through. But it's still unsettling to us. There's like, is there not more to the answer? It doesn't seem fair that God is doing this. Now, I'm a dad, and one of my favorite lines with my kids is, life isn't, parents help me out, fair. Life isn't fair. We all know that. And when we say that to our kids, we're like, man, I'm really a good parent because I used that line. And that was the line that was used on me. But you know, if parents, sorry, you know, kids, we're going to kind of be honest here for a minute. Like parents, even though we say that, and even though I think we mean it, isn't it true that in our own lives and in our own circumstances, when things are unfair with us, we still kind of shake our fist and say life isn't fair, right? We still say that because we hope for it to be fair. We want it to be fair. We expect it to be fair. We get frustrated when it's not fair. Why do the wicked prosper? It's not fair. That's a difficult question. But you know what a harder question is? A harder question is, why do the wicked prosper and then the righteous suffer? That's a harder question. You know what's even a harder question? Why do the wicked prosper at the expense of the righteous? I mean, that's what we're talking about here. God's saying to his people, the Babylonians are going to expand to become more powerful. They're going to come in, and they're going to take you in as slave labor. They're going to plunder all your stuff. They're going to amass more power so they can conquer more nations. And the wicked are actually prospering while you are going to be punished and you are going to be defeated. I mean, if this isn't settling well with you, I think you're among good company here. I think this is what the prophet is working through. Certainly God is going to deal with these people, right? Now, how do we respond when God allows us to experience all of this hurt? These questions that we have, this kind of unsettled feeling, this is the same thing the prophet was working through. And so the prophet confronts God a second time. He's like, okay, God didn't smite me after my first round of questions, so I'm going to tread carefully, but I'm going to go back to God and ask him some more questions. Verse 12, Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, you will never die. You, Lord, have appointed them to execute judgment. You, my rock, the one I trust, the one I rely on, yet you have ordained them to punish. You know, I think Habakkuk is a little bit more calm in the way he is presenting his questions, but his questions are still just as intense as we saw in the beginning of chapter 1. You can kind of sense how incredulous the prophet is. God, I don't understand this. He says, God, you're perfect. The Babylonians are far from perfect. And certainly, the prophet would say, your people aren't perfect, but do we really deserve this? Verse 13, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrongdoing. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? He says, look, God, I'll be honest. Your people aren't doing so great, but we're better than the Babylonians. This doesn't make sense. See, the Babylonians were the kind of people who wiped nations out. And the prophet is like, God, are you going to annihilate us? Are we just going to be torn to pieces? You know, there are times in life where we face kind of injustices and frustrations and questions, and don't we just say, God, am I going to make it through this? Can I survive through this situation? This is what the prophet's worried about here with the Babylonians. Verse 14, you've made your people like fish in the sea, like the sea creatures that have no ruler. The prophet says, we have no ruler. This is our problem. No one to lead us. Verse 15, the wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet so that he rejoices and is glad. He's like, God, we're like a fish in a barrel. And all the enemy has to do is reach in with a net and just scoop us up. The enemy's taking advantage of the situation. The prophet knows, Habakkuk knows that God desires to create his order, his world, and he wants to establish his way through his people. And the prophet says, if you just allow us to be annihilated, then how are you going to establish your order in the world here? Verse 16, therefore he, the Babylonians, sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys choicest food. The prophet says, God, if you do these things, these people aren't going to give you credit. No one's going to give you credit because they're offering sacrifice to their nets. They're worshiping the nets because they think the nets are the things that are doing it for them. They burn incense to their dragnets. God, how does this honor you at all? They're going to steal all the credit. And this is what we see in our world as well, right? We face trial, we face persecution, we face chaos around us, and we see people worshiping what makes them successful. We see people boasting about their wealth, boasting about their talents and their abilities, people that manipulate and con their way all the way to the top and all the while giving themselves the credit. The prophet ends his questions with this. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? I think as the prophet is verbally processing his questions, I think he's getting to a point where he's going to accept what God said he will do, but in desperation, right here, the prophet says, God, how long is this going to last? You see, Habakkuk was looking for the punishment of the wicked so that the prosperity of his people could be assured. But God's plan was to punish his people so that fellowship with them could be restored. See, what's happening here is that God is hurting his people to heal his people. God is hurting his people to heal his people. And I don't know why God, in his sovereignty, used a pagan nation to conquer his people in this way. I don't know why the prophets weren't more successful in their calling that they made in the generations that led up to that point. I don't know why God didn't choose another means, but he chose this means. I don't know why today you and I, we face trials and pain, oftentimes at the expense of wicked and broken people in our world. But I know that sometimes God allows us to experience hurt, even great hurt and pain, in order to heal us. So at this point, the prophet has a choice to make, doesn't he? He has a choice to make. His doubts can be destructive to his faith or constructive to his faith. His doubts can turn him away from God or they can turn him to God. He has to decide, am I going to trust in what I know about God? I know that God, look, I know God is good. I know he has a plan for his people. He wants to be in relationship with his people. He wants to restore his people. And I know that God has said that these people are guilty. So God's got a bigger thing going on here than I can understand. And he can either trust what he knows. He can either trust that the hurt that he's experiencing is ultimately going to bring healing, or he can turn away from his faith. He had to decide, is he going to trust this hurt is going to bring healing? You know, I've had a choice the last several weeks as I've seen this physical therapist. I've had a choice. Do I go to physical therapy and endure the pain? Do I go knowing the discomfort that I'm going to experience? Or do I ignore it and hope it goes away, which really is ultimately going to end up in the shoulder being more injured down the road in the future? I have to trust that the process is going to bring healing. This past week, late in my study for this passage, I came across this quote from C.S. Lewis. And when I came across it, I was like, man, I got to share this. It's longer than I normally like to share. It's a long quote. It's from a short book that C.S. Lewis wrote called A Grief Observed. So it's several slides here, but I want to read it because it just perfectly, I think, encapsulates what we're talking about here. He says this: the more we believe that God hurts only to heal, the less we can believe that there is any use in begging for tenderness. A cruel man can be bribed. But suppose that what you are up against is a surgeon whose intentions are wholly good. The kinder and more conscientious he is, the more inexorably he will go on cutting. If he yielded to your entreaties, if he stopped before the operation was complete, all the pain up to that point would have been useless. But is it credible that such extremities of torture should be necessary for us? Well, take your choice. The tortures occur. If they are unnecessary, then there is no God or a bad one. If there is a good God, then these tortures are necessary. For no even moderately good being could possibly inflict or permit them if they weren't. Either way, we're for it. I love that last line, that last sentence. Either way, we're for it. C.S. Lewis recognized that hurt can heal, and he's for that because he knows that he needs healing. He knows that it's worth it to go through the pain so that he can experience the healing on the other side. He's going to embrace it, and he's going to accept it. And this is what I've done with my physical therapy. I've said, look, I am for it. I'm going to experience it. I'm going to embrace it. I'm for it. I'm going to lean into it. And thankfully, what we see here in the book of Habakkuk, the prophet recognized this as well, and he made his decision to turn to the Lord. Chapter 2, verse 1 says this. It's the final part of his second complaint. He says, I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. The prophet says, I am for it. After all his striving and all his pleading and all his questioning, Habakkuk now positions himself to receive an answer. He understands that he can present honest questions with sincere faith, but he also understands his position. He's not lecturing God. He's not telling God that he's doing the wrong thing, but he's petitioning, and now he's saying, look, I'm going to submit, I'm going to trust in faith that this hurt will bring the healing that we need. He uses this language of a military sentry to describe what he's going to do. He commits to watchful vigilance. Now, usually the prophets, what they would do is they would watch the people for them to see if they would make an error of their ways, and he would call out to them and call them back into relationship with God. But as Habakkuk has kind of done in the rest of his book here, he's kind of turned things around here. He doesn't look at the people, but he looks to God, and he watches and he waits to see how God will respond. Look, church, when your circumstances are beyond our control, don't look to your own strength to get you through it. Instead, turn your eyes to the Lord, who is working things out according to his wisdom and his plan. I know that there are many people here who have experienced and are experiencing really difficult things in your life right now. And the questions that the prophet had at the beginning of chapter 1 and in the latter part of chapter 1, these are the questions that you have as well. God, where are you? What are you doing? How can you allow this to happen? Don't you see me? Don't you see my circumstances? Don't you know? Don't you understand? Why aren't you responding? I've been praying. I've been waiting. I've been trying to do all the things right. When people ask why bad things happen to good people, we need to realize that the worst thing happened only once, and Jesus volunteered for it. This is what happened in the garden with Jesus. What does he say? Not my will be done, but your will be done. Jesus said, I'm for it. I'm for it. I am willing to endure pain for the healing of humanity. That's what Jesus said. I am willing to endure the pain because I know where it's going to lead. He did that for you. He came to live the life that you couldn't live. And he died the death that you deserve. He experienced the pain that you deserved so that you could experience the healing, the forgiveness that you couldn't earn. Look, I don't mean to minimize your pain or your suffering today, but any discussion about how pain and suffering fits into God's plan, it ultimately leads us back to the cross. Jesus didn't just face excruciating physical pain on the cross, though he did. Extreme torture, one of the worst forms of death ever created by man. The greater pain, I think, that Jesus experienced on the cross were in those words, my God, why have you forsaken me? He experienced cosmic abandonment on the cross, where he was one with the Father, and when he bore our sin on the cross, that separation from the Father in that moment was the worst kind of pain there. His relationship with the Father was severed. And he suffered on our behalf. Look, your pain is real, your trial may be long, and your endurance, your ability to endure that may be fading. But I want to encourage us today to respond in the same way that Habakkuk responded. In faith, trusting in who God is, turning to him to say, I'm going to stand, and I'm going to look, and I'm going to watch, and I'm going to listen for what you are going to do. The pain may be great, but God, I'm going to believe that the healing is coming. The hurt that I'm enduring now may be overwhelming, but God, I'm trusting that you are who you say you are. You are a good God. I'm going to lean into you. I'm not going to allow the chaos and the confusion around me to drown that out. I'm going to cling to you. I'm going to stand on the ramparts, and I'm going to look, and I'm going to listen, and I'm going to watch for you, and I want to see when it comes, and when it does, I'll be rejoicing. This is what the prophet did. This is what we are to do. This is what Christ did on our behalf. There's two ways for us to respond today. And the first is for those of us in the room who do not have a relationship with God. First is accept the pain, the sacrifice that Jesus endured on the cross on your behalf to heal your wound of sin. You see, the reality is when the prophet prophesied or when he was ministering to the southern kingdom of Judah, the people of Judah, they had sinned for generations. They had messed up. They had turned away from God, and there was a judgment that was necessary that was coming. And if you're here today and you're far from God, you know, man, I've sinned. I've separated myself from God. I've made decisions that are contrary to his will and to his way. I want to encourage you today to accept the pain, the sacrifice that Jesus endured on your behalf on the cross in order to heal the wounds that are caused by that sin. Romans 10:13 says, everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. And so today, I want to encourage you to respond in that way. And for those of us who are believers in the room, you may or may not be going through a trial. You may or may not be going through all these questions that the prophet is asking. I want to encourage you today to stand, to look, and to listen for the Lord in the midst of your pain. In the midst of your pain, take that verse one of chapter 2, and write that down. Make that your prayer this week. I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. Make that your determination this week. God, I'm going to trust you in the midst of this hurt that you're going to bring healing to my life. Would you pray with me? God, we ask today that you would help us, that you would speak to us. God, this is not a sitcom ending. Things don't get buttoned up with feel-good resolve at the end of this chapter, God. But Lord, we recognize in life is not usually that clean. Usually it's messy. And so, God, I know that there are people in this room who are walking just through difficult, difficult circumstances. And I pray that in the midst of that, they would see that through hurt, you can bring healing. Through trial, you can bring victory. Through suffering, you can bring wholeness. And so, Lord, I ask that for those people in this room today who are just walking through just devastating circumstances, God, I pray that they would rise up in faith and they would look to you and say, I'm going to stand, I'm going to watch, and I'm going to listen. That they would say, I am for it. Just like the prophet did. Just like Jesus did on the cross for our behalf. Help us, God, to be people that say, I am for it. Lord, I pray for those who are far from you, who don't have a relationship with you. We don't like conviction, but God, I pray for conviction. I pray that there would be clarity in their heart of their need for you, that you would help them to recognize, God, that they need to confess their sin and turn to you. And as they call out to you, Lord, I pray, God, that they would experience salvation, transformation. In Jesus' name. Keep your eyes closed for just a moment. If you're here today and you'd say, Pastor Eric, I need to respond to that first one. I'm far from God. And I want to have a relationship with him. You say, I just need to call out to God for him to save me because I've done some things that I've created some pain in my life on my own, not to mention other things I'm dealing with, but I've sinned. And I've separated myself from God. And today, if you want to respond and say, Pastor Eric, I want to call out to God. I want to be saved today. I'm just going to ask you to do something simple for me. I'd like just to ask you to raise your hand. Raise it up real high right now if you would. I want to pray for you. I just want to be able to know who I'm praying for in particular. So if you're here today and you're responding in that way, I want to give you a moment to respond. Thank you. Let's do this. Let's stand, if you would, with me. We're going to move to a time of response. This is an important time in our services where we respond to what God has been speaking to us through his word. So there's a couple ways that you can respond. We've got a little thing on this card here called My Response. You can mark one of those. But in particular, I want to call your attention to two spots. One on the front. If you're here today and you would say, I'm responding to that first one. I need to accept the pain that Jesus endured on the cross on my behalf. On the front of that card, it says, I have decided to follow Jesus. If you can mark that, at the end of the service, we'll have some people at the doors with some buckets. You can fold it up and just put that in the bucket there when you leave. This is just a way for us to kind of help you on your journey. I want to pray with you. I want to just give you a call. Just give me some way to contact you this week, and I'll reach out to you. But if you responded to that today, I want to ask you to mark that. And then for the rest of you, there's a prayer request and a sermon response area on the back. We changed the wording there. It used to just say prayer request. This is a spot for you, man. If something is going on in your life and you would want particular prayer for, you can write any prayer request on here. But if the message is speaking to you in some way where you want me to pray for you about a response for the message and our pastoral staff to pray for you, go ahead and maybe circle sermon response and write that down. And we'll be praying for you about that throughout the week here. This is just kind of a way where you can use that. Now, we're changing that there. This is really not it's not a complaint card, okay? If you got something that's outside of the service, just call me. The complaint card is a phone call to me, okay? So let's not just, put anonymous comments on there and things like that. If you do, I've instructed our staff not to show them to me, so if you've been doing that, sorry, they don't come to me. But use that as a sermon response or a prayer request area. And if you have a complaint, I would love to hear it. Just call me, okay? Little side note there. Here's the deal. Let's respond today to what God is doing in our lives. There's a couple ways we can respond. Prayer team, if you can come on forward. Maybe you've got something that you need prayer for. Every week, we provide an opportunity for you to be prayed for. It could be for a particular need, or you just say, hey, I like people praying for me. That's what these people are here for. If you have a need that's sensitive, they'll keep it confidential. You can tell them to pass it along to the rest of the prayer team if you'd like. Another way that we respond is through coming forward and kneeling down at the steps here. We call this our altar area. And I do this just about every week where I will pray and I will talk to God. And this is my way. I know I'm kneeling, but I'm going to pray, God, I want to stand and look and listen for what it is that you want to do in my life. I'm going to trust you. I'm for it, God. I'm willing to experience the hurt in order to experience the healing. So I'm going to do that. It's a way for me to move and physically say, that's what I'm praying about. The third way we're going to respond today is through worship. We're going to sing a few songs, a couple songs of worship. And so today, as the worship team leads us, respond in one of those three ways. Come forward for prayer. Come forward and pray on your own, or worship. But let's respond and let's be the kind of people that say, I am for it. I'm willing to experience the hurt in order to experience the healing. Worship team, would you lead us?